Chic back in the 1970s, the days of disco magic and also free love, introduced us here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Harrod, where we like to look at important issues of the day for conservatives and others. And today we want to discuss the Equality Act currently under consideration in the United States Senate. After having passed the House and is supported by the administration of President Joe Biden, this act would amend sexual discrimination laws to include what's called SOGI, sexual orientation and gender identity. And to discuss this issue and the various dangers that it presents, we have Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morse, the founder of the Ruth Institute, which examines issues of human sexuality and life and the family, and is also the author of The Sexual State, How Elite Ideologies Are Destroying Lives, and Why the Church Was Right All Along, an excellent book which I've actually reviewed before. Well, to discuss these issues, here's Jennifer Roback-Morse. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Andrew. I really appreciate it.
Well, looking at this, first I explain that for our listeners, a general introduction, what does the Equality Act do?
Well, your short version there is legally correct. You know, it amends discrimination law to include sexual orientation and gender identity. And that's the thing that has people really concerned, is the gender identity part of it, because that's a term that's not well defined, a term that really, really shouldn't be in law, right? Because you self-identify yourself into the so-called protected class. So if you say you're a woman, Andrew, I'm supposed to call you a woman, and you now have access to women's bathrooms, women's sports. If you are if you're convicted of a crime, you'd be put into a women's prison. Even if the crime you've been convicted of is rape and assault on women, you'd be housed in a women's prison. You know, normal people see some problems with this whole thing going forward.
Yes, indeed. There have been issues both in the United States and abroad I've come across where rapists who identify as transgender, as women, have indeed been placed then in women's prisons. And, of course, they've gone on to rape other women in prison. So a key danger there, also involving issues that have come up of, for example, homeless shelters with the I believe it was the Salvation Army in New York State. You had there an issue where men who identified as women, they wanted to go into women's sections of homeless shelters and use lavatories and showers and so forth with other women. So, yes, these are really key concerns. And as you mentioned, it's interesting that when we talk about such a protected class under these sex discrimination laws, under various discrimination laws, here we have a case where it's not an immutable class, as is the case with, say, race or ethnicity, but it's something I can just self-identify with. I could be, say, gender fluid. Maybe at times I could identify as male, and at other times I could identify as female, maybe on odd days of the week or even days of the week or whatever. It's just something I can identify with. How does this decision differ from or add to the recent United States Supreme Court Bostock decision written surprisingly by a conservative Justice Neil Gorsuch.
Well, I think it's an attempt to get the machinery of the federal government in alignment with the whole transgender agenda. That's the way I would describe it. And what it adds specifically to that ruling, I'm not 100% sure, because I'm not 100% sure what that ruling does that's distinct here. But this is much broader, and so that's why it's an area of concern. And but you know, the one thing we haven't mentioned yet, Andrew, that I think conservatives and everybody should be really concerned about, is that this whole approach to enacting transgenderism into law, whether you do it through the courts or whether you do it through legislation, as we're doing here. However you do this, you're asking people, you're commanding people to lie. The people in power are saying that we must call Bruce Jenner a woman. We must call Dr. Richard Levine, Dr. Rachel Levine, and refer to him using female pronouns, you know. And so I think it would be I think that's the deepest issue. That's the deepest problem. You see what I mean? Because that is, if they can make you say Bruce Jenner's a woman, they can make you say or do anything. And I think that's the real point of the whole thing.
Yeah, you mentioned that before in your book, The Sexual State, this whole issue of power and making people, as Rod Dreher has written in his recent book, Live Not by Lies, addressing this issue of sexual revolution and this whole gender revolution of forcing people to simply say a lie. It's brought up analogies with other totalitarianisms in the past, communist states. You know, you think of Václav Havel, the former president of the Czech Republic and a dissident during the communist era in Eastern Europe. He wrote a play about how a foreign power occupied a country or society and also imposed upon the society a new foreign language, which really no one believed in, but everyone had to speak it. You had to say it. I mean, thinking in terms of communist states, you have to say things like dictatorship of the proletariat or fulfill the five-year plan or the glory of socialism, fight imperialism, or whatever, even though, you know, you really don't believe any of this communist ideology, but you have to go along with it to please the powers that be. And now we have with this Rachel Levine, who's been nominated by the Biden administration to be an assistant secretary at Health and Human Services. This individual is actually, it was a man in high school. He played football as Richard Levine, his given name, and then married a woman and had two children with this woman. So became a father, but now this father is supposedly a woman, and you have this whole concept of dead naming. You're not supposed to refer to this Rachel Levine as Richard Levine, but that Richard Levine person, or for that matter, Bruce Jenner, is now dead. There's occurred this sort of psychological suicide, you might call it, that a person has killed off their former identity, and now they're demanding to sort of be reincarnated or to rise as a phoenix as this new women, and we're all supposed to go along with this. This is really bizarre.
Well, and you know, I'm glad you brought up Eastern Europe and Václav Havel. I'm very glad you brought that up, because the part of the point he's making is the psychological damage that is done to people when they are saying things they know to be untrue. Okay, that was in a way the deepest point that he was making, that something is going on inside the psyche. And so it's not just that the communists are bossing everybody around in Czechoslovakia. It's not just that they're yelling at you and putting you in jail and things like that. They're also trying to get inside your head, you know. And so I think that what we're dealing with the whole sexual revolution is that psychological warfare has been a part of it from the very beginning, because it's truthfully a war on human nature. I mean, there are aspects of human nature and nature itself, you know, the natural condition that they despise and that they're at war with, you know, and so the fact that we're male and female, and that is an immutable fact of your own personal biology. You're a man, I'm a woman. That's that, you know. The revolutionaries despise that fact, Andrew. And that, and so they're at war with it. And so trying to get people to, you know, they want to destabilize that and make it so you're not sure of who you are exactly, so that the whole gender-free world can be ushered in. And that they've been at work at that for a long time, you know, for a long time.
Yeah, that raises issues. For example, in recent readings from various other Catholics on this issue, it's been noted that the philosophical doctrine about the human body that the Church and others have promoted, the Catholic Church and others have advocated and stood for, that there's a personal integrity of body and soul in human beings, and that therefore, if I'm pronouncing this right, human beings are hylomorphic. All right, that you have this unity of body and soul, and you can't
yes.
divide body and soul. If you're a male person and you're born into a male body, I can't just simply in my own mind, in my own spirit, identify as a woman and sort of detach myself from my physical body as a man. And so you have this detachment of body and soul in these individuals who want to identify as another gender, and then now they're sort of imposing upon society as well in order to have this approval so that they can feel well, that we also have to sort of separate our bodies and souls, that I have to, in my mind, I know that this is wrong, but in terms of my behavior and my life, I have to go around and pretend that
That's right.
everything's all right here.
That's right. That's
yeah,
right. And moreover, you know, if you're the type of person who wants unlimited power, which I'm sure none of your listeners are that type of person, so we have to focus on this for just a moment. You know, the average person, I think, consistently underestimates the malice of the totalitarian mind. Okay, so you know, the people who were at work in the communist Eastern Bloc, the people who were at work in Nazi Germany, and so on and so forth. There are the foot soldiers who go along with it. Because they don't want any trouble, and they want to have a normal, decent life. But the people at the top of the thing know exactly what they're doing, and I think it's no mistake that they put Rachel Levine was nominated for this position, and I will tell you why. Richard Levine, he changed his name to Rachel. So let's get some terminology clear first off. He changed his name to Rachel. He legally changed his name to Rachel. Okay, that's fine. You can change your name to anything you want. So I'm okay to change it. You know, if he says he's Rachel, okay, I'll call him Rachel. But I will not say that he's a man, that he's a woman. I'm not going to say he's a woman. Changing your name to Rachel doesn't make you a woman any more than changing your name to Daffy would make you a duck. Okay? So if he changed his name to Daffy, I'd call him Daffy. That'd be fine. But here's the thing. If you look at this man's picture when he's dressed up as a woman, he's not even remotely plausible as a woman. He is not passing as a woman. There are some guys who go this route and they can kind of pass. This guy cannot pass. All right, let's just be real clear. When you're in the presence of a man who says he's a woman, and I honestly, Andrew, I think that's the right terminology to use. We can talk about that in a minute. But when you're in the presence of a man who says he's a woman, you are going, sooner or later, you're going to slip and use the wrong pronoun. Sooner or later, you're going to say yes, sir, instead of yes, ma'am. That's going to happen, okay? And so then what? If you're a person in power and you want to be controlling people, that means the person in power can take you in, can take you down, can give you a hard time, can punish you whenever they want to, basically, because sooner or later somebody is going to infringe the new rule that this person has invented around themselves. See, and I think that's why this person was chosen for this job. That's the whole point. The whole point is not that this is the best qualified person to be Assistant Secretary of Health and Human Services. It's not that we want to be nice to all these poor kids who are gender dysphoric, and isn't this a great role model for them? That's not the point. The point is, everybody has to genuflect to Rachel. Everybody has to genuflect to the correct pronouns, right, and the correct words. That is the point. Everything else is window dressing. And when you're dealing with psychological warfare, you got to be on the lookout. You got to be very clear about what's real and what is what's secondary. You know, what's the main point that they're really after? versus the sideshow, the diversionary tactics. You've got to be on the lookout for diversionary tactics. And we're just flooded with them, of course, all the time on this issue.
Yeah, one thing I thought of, it's occurred to me, I mean, thinking of another sort of political power, maybe totalitarian analogy, you know, we've had this whole debate come up in recent years about Confederate symbols and monuments and names and so forth, and now there's the issue that's come up of renaming military bases all throughout the South that have these Confederate names, Fort Hood, Texas, named after John Bell Hood, a Texan Confederate officer, or officer rather from Kentucky, who commanded the Texas Brigade and in Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia, or Fort Benning in Georgia, named after Toombs Benning, this pro-slavery Georgia politician who then commanded a Georgia Brigade in the Army of Northern Virginia during the Civil War, or Fort Bragg in North Carolina, named after Braxton Bragg, commanded Confederate armies at like battles of Chattanooga and so forth. And people have noted that these generals like John Bell Hood or Braxton Bragg, they weren't maybe necessarily the best generals. I mean, Braxton Bragg was known to always get like angry at people and had a bad relationship with Jefferson Davis. And John Bell Hood was known as perhaps a good brigade or division commander, a hard fighter. But at a more higher level as an army commander, he didn't really have a very good strategic sense and just really sort of destroyed the Army of Tennessee under his command in 1864.
Where are you going with this? Where are you going?
Well, I'm saying that
do we care about their history?
The point that people make is that, you know, these bases were named by commissions that had Southern populations who suggested the names for these bases. It was local politicians who named these bases. And the whole point was then really to honor the Confederacy. And so it seems to me that similarly with a transgendered individual, like this gender dysphoria, so-called transgendered individual, Rachel Levine, you know, he actually had a lot of people criticize his health record in Pennsylvania that he put, you know, all these people to retirement homes that had COVID-19, and like in New York, and people died. So it's really, you know, we're just saying, once again, it's not for this Mr. Levine or Rachel Levine individual that we want him in a healthcare position, but rather it's, we want a symbol. We want to honor this whole transgender ideology.
Well, the reason I'm hesitating about the whole question of namings and monuments and things like that is because the people who are out and about tearing down monuments are in fact very indiscriminate about it. And so you could make a case for why Fort Hood shouldn't have been named for that particular person or whatever. You could make that case. I think that's a diversionary tactic, Andrew. You know, that whole question is utterly irrelevant. If the same people are also tearing down statues of Abraham Lincoln, there's something at work besides the worthiness of the particular person, okay? And I think what's at work with the guys tearing down statues, I think it has to do with tearing down history itself, tearing down the past, any aspect of the past. George Washington, if you can't tell the difference between George Washington and Harriet Tubman and some of these other people that maybe are implicated in slavery, well, then slavery doesn't have anything to do with it. You know, that's not really the point. The point is to wipe out history so that you can start fresh every day. Well, if you start fresh every day, what are you doing? You have no law then. You have only the law of the strongest. And I think, honestly, that the denigration of U.S. history by the totalitarian mindset, you know, I think that's the ultimate point of that. So I wouldn't get personally, I think it's a sidetrack to get wrapped up in the question of who's worthy of being named of having something named for them or having a statue and so on and so forth. That's not the point. The point is they want to take down our monuments and put up their monuments. They want to have no history. They want a clean slate every day so that the law can be whatever they want it to be that day. That's what it's all about. Because you can't have law without history. Law and history are inevitably and inexorably linked to one another because the law is written down. And the next day you go, oh, well, this is the law. This is what I'm supposed to do, right? But if there's no past, then you don't have anything with that kind of authority. And then you've got the law of the strongest.
Yeah, I think I would make the analogy that all of this radicalism with monuments and sexuality, it's sort of like a another French revolutionary moment. You know, we're going to have the year zero, just everything's going to be overthrown.
Every day. That's exactly what they want, Andrew. I think that's exactly right. And in my book, The Sexual State, which was very kind of you to review and very kind of you to refer to it, you know, I try to point out in that book that we've basically been under attack for a long time here, that the sexual revolution from the beginning has been a power grab. And the various things that have been presented as innovations in freedom and modernity, and, you know, you really need to be up to date, you know, you get rid of these old tired views and so on and so forth. Then really behind each one of them, you can go through and say, you know, it was actually a power grab. You're less free now than you were before. And I think that's certainly the case with the whole issue of surrounding gender dysphoria. The medicine surrounding gender dysphoria is ridiculous that they expect us to believe that chopping off healthy body parts is the solution to somebody's psychological problem. That's ridiculous. And yet that is what we're all expected to believe. You know, I mean, that's true in the United States government, is true at the United Nations. You know, there's a move afoot at the United Nations to be enshrining these things into various forms of, you know, international treaties and laws and that kind of stuff. It's everywhere. It's a global ruling class, really, Andrew, who are all in for the idea that the human body is not significant. We get to do whatever we want with it. Going back to the point you made a little bit earlier, you know, the person as a union of body and soul is somehow offensive to their mind. You know, they want to be able to do whatever they want with their body, to their body, and have everybody else go along with it. You know, and you can't have a real social order doing something like that. It's going to be antisocial, and you're going to have disorder. You know, and that's what we're dealing with.
Yeah, it brings up another person who's talked about this issue and spoken about this issue is Stella Morabito, who is a former analyst for the CIA and is engaged in precisely this analysis of things like psychological warfare to examine.
She's great.
This whole
she is great.
Yeah.
I totally get – sorry to interrupt, but, yeah, I love Stella's stuff. She's very important. Go ahead. Say more.
Yeah, she spoke at the Family Research Council where I saw her in particular. It brings to mind, too, is – your whole phrase of, if I can make you say Bruce make you afraid to say that Bruce Jenner is a man, I can make you do anything. One aspect I brought up with Stella was the issue of it's somewhat strange that you have all of these sort of Muslim groups, often with, you know, sort of nefarious Muslim Brotherhood background, sort of Islamist oriented, that are going along in a sort of what's called red-green political coalition with all of these sexual revolutionaries. And it's occurred to me that they would like to create a climate of fear, a society of fear, because then they can also, say, suppress, make people afraid to offer any criticism of Islam or Sharia law or other such issues.
I think that's a really interesting point. And I've puzzled over that myself for a while, you know. Why are these guys allies, you know? You wouldn't think this is a natural alliance, you know. But I think in part, it's what you just said there is one of the keys to understanding it, at least as far as I can understand it, because, you know, there's a deep mystery going on here in a certain way. But I think they sense a kindred spirit with each other. In other words, they each, you know, the sexual revolutionaries and the Islamists, they have a vision of society that they think will bring about heaven on earth, I suppose you could say. And they're willing to do anything to get it, you know. So there's a totalitarian impulse at work in both cases. And so they recognize a kind of kindred spirit between each other. And so it's certainly the case that they have a common enemy, right? And their common enemy is the kind of Christianity, which would be typified by traditional Catholicism, the kind of Christianity that says, you know, there is an order to the universe, and God is a God of reason, and we are to respect the order in the universe and cooperate with it, and that's the key to happiness, you know, to align ourselves with the cosmos defined in that way. That's the key to happiness, and trying to recreate it all in our own image, that's never going to work. That's never going to work. And God himself would not do that. God himself is not going to pull the rug out from under us and say what was black yesterday is now white today. God isn't going to do that. And so people and those of us who think we're a problem, we're a problem to the totalitarians. That's a point.
Yeah, that brings up issues. Stella Morabito, when I brought up this issue in a question to her at the Family Research Council, she made the phrase that these two groups of Islamists and all these sexual revolutionaries, they have a tacit non-aggression pact, you know, harkening back to the red-brown alliance, you might call it, between the communists under Joseph Stalin, the Soviet Union, and the Nazis under Adolf Hitler when they signed their 1939 non-aggression pact. And so, you know, I think also Pamela Geller, this political activist, anti-Sharia activist, you know, she's also noted in the past that the political left on the one hand and these Islamists on the other hand, you know, they both have this desire for power, that this power thing that really unites them. So, yeah, there are indeed a lot of ironically parallel currents there, even though they have such different ideas about human sexuality in particular.
Right. So let's go back to the issue at hand. We've kind of taken some detours here and go back to the Equality Act, you know. Let's go back to
the Equality Act. One thing else, have any states passed laws similar to the Equality Act, and what has been their experience?
You know, I can't answer that, Andrew. I would prefer not to answer that because I don't know.
Well, then looking particularly at the Equality Act, will then it be possible under this act, could anyone make any, express any opposition to homosexuality or to cross-dressing in any workplace under this act? I think, for example, in past cases, way back in like 2004, there was an incident in Virginia where a person put a bumper sticker on their car in Harrisonburg, Virginia. He was actually just a resident alien here, just someone working here, and he put a bumper sticker on his car saying marriage is between one man and one woman, and there were complaints that people didn't want him showing up at this meatpacking factory with this bumper sticker on his car and wanted the bumper sticker removed, and he went to court and sued and had that free speech right protected. Or more recently under, I guess it was in the early Trump, the first year of Trump's administration, there was a meatpacking facility in Michigan, I think, was going up for FDA certification, and the FDA worker said, this guy has some literature saying that marriage should be between a man and a woman, and this is harassment. We want removed before we're going to approve this, give this federal approval to this meat company. Will that be possible under this act? What's going to happen there?
Well, you know, those kind of detailed cases that you're talking about, those particular ones I'm not familiar with, but I wouldn't be a bit surprised if that wouldn't be at stake. Let me give you a different kind of example of the sexual state at work, okay? Because what you just cited there is the sexual state at work. So what was the agency involved there? Whoever was giving approval for the meatpacking plant? What was like a health and safety organization? Is that what it was?
Right, Food and Drug Administration,
The FDA, okay. So just not too long ago, something happened in California, naturally, California. In California, but it was the California Insurance Commissioner. Now, that is a relatively obscure regulatory agency, right? Most people don't think about insurance commissioners as being a big thing, okay? But what happened in California is that an activist group in San Diego sent a question to the California Insurance Commissioner, and their question was this: if an insurance company allows chest reconstruction surgery for minors, can they deny chest reconstruction surgery for minors who want it because they want to cure their gender dysphoria? Okay, so in other words, they took this very narrow, obscure ruling, and the commissioner said, oh my goodness, yes, that's discrimination. That would be terrible to say that you can have chest reconstruction surgery after a car accident or for breast cancer. but not permit, quote, chest reconstruction surgery for a transgender youth. If you deny the transgender youth the insurance coverage to remove their breasts, because but they don't say remove their breasts, Andrew, but that's what they're talking about, right? They don't say that. They call it chest reconstruction surgery. So the net result of this ruling is that insurance companies are required, in effect, are required to pay for the removal of healthy breast tissue for girls who think they're boys, who are requesting this for whatever reason they're requesting it, that to say, because you're only 15 and you don't really know what the heck you're doing, they're not allowed to say, you don't know what the heck you're doing at the age of 15. If they would cover chest reconstruction surgery after a car accident for a 15-year-old, no question asked, they must cover chest reconstruction surgery for a gender dysphoria patient, no questions asked. Okay, that was done by one little obscure insurance commission, right? And this is the sexual state at work. So what's going to happen with the Equality Act is that the realm of discretion for any agency of that kind is going to be narrowed, and they're going to be forced down the channel, forcing the gender ideology in some form or fashion, whether it's the gender ideology directly or whether it's the things that are specific to transsexualism and changing sex and what is called, euphemistically called, gender affirmation surgery. See, that's all going to be required. Any discretion anybody ever had is going to be greatly limited by the Equality Act.
Wow, that's really interesting. So you're calling breast reconstruction surgery, now it's actually being defined to encompass precisely the destruction of breasts, the removal
right.
of breasts.
That's exactly right. And so you see part of the PSYOP, part of the psychological operation, is the manipulation of language. And you just chuckled over that, right? And rightly so, because it's like it's ridiculous in a way, right? But on the other hand, it's deadly serious, right? It's deadly serious. They have people saying gender affirmation surgery. That's the new politically correct term for the removal of healthy body parts from a person who says who requests it, okay? So gender affirmation surgery, you're affirming their gender, namely their social presentation of themselves, as opposed to their sex, which sex cannot be reassigned. Sex is biological and permanent. You can't reassign that. So they stopped saying sex reassignment surgery, and they're now saying gender affirmation surgery.
Boy, got to keep up with the lingo.
Serious business. But they have to keep redefining the lingo, Andrew. They have to keep doing that, right? Because what they're advocating is crazy and can't be done. So they got to keep you off balance by changing the words all the time. Now, that's why it's very important that you call them out every time, that you not use their language, right? That you are as clear as you possibly can be in using the language that says what you want it to say, rather than, you know, a following down the rabbit hole of these people who are trying to get inside your head. One phraseology I would recommend to you and to your listeners is this. In the early days of transgenderism being on the scene, people kind of not knowing how to respond to it and stuff, people would sometimes refer to a person as gender confused, a gender confused person, a gender confused child, or something like that. I don't like that usage. I don't use that usage anymore. And here's why. I think it's better to say Dr. Levine is a man who says he's a woman. He's a man who says he's a woman. It's undeniable that he's a man. It's undeniable that he says he's a woman. I do not know why he says he's a woman. Maybe he's confused. It's possible he's confused. It's also possible that he's not confused. Maybe he likes being the center of attention. Maybe he gets sexually aroused, seeing himself in women's clothes. I don't know. I have no idea why he says he's a woman. But it is an undeniable fact that he says he's a woman. And so I think it's best to use that kind of language and then let him deal with it. Let him pop up and tell you why he says that, you know, right? Put that back on them. And the lack of clarity, put that back on them to clarify what the issue is.
Yeah, that's an interesting description. That would encompass both then Rachel Levine now, or for that matter, you know, Corporal Klinger and MASH, who, you know, famously in the series was always trying to get kicked out of the Army and out of the Korean War by presenting himself as a woman and dressing as a woman. So, yeah, you can just state the facts like that.
That's right. Exactly. That's another somewhat humorous but valid, perfectly valid example, right? He says he's a woman. He has his reasons. We don't know what his reasons are. We're not judging his reasons. We're just going to go with the fact. For now, we're just going to go with the undeniable fact that this is what he says about himself.
Yeah, and as you indicated before, of course, these issues are ultimately very serious. I mean, I think of this whole breast removal issue or gender affirmation surgery. A case arose recently, I guess about a year ago or so, noted by the Family Research Council in their news briefs, an autistic teenager, I believe it was in Oregon, where there under state law, teenagers can go through these surgeries without notifying their parents. She had her breasts removed, and the first thing the parents heard about was, you know, when they saw their daughter without any breasts anymore, just scars on her chest where the breasts had been removed, and they were just, of course, horrified at what had happened.
Yeah. It's horrible. It's really horrible. And this in that particular issue of parents being notified, that aspect of the sexual revolution has been in place for quite a while, Andrew. And I don't know if your listeners are fully aware of this, but minors can receive contraception without their parents knowing about it. Minors can get an abortion without their parents knowing about it. I mean, that's why parental notification is such a big issue in a lot of these states. And the vehicle for getting that done has been Medicaid and Medicare payments. Okay, so if the state receives these federal funds, the federal law is that you must distribute these you must distribute contraceptives without regard to the person's age and without regard to the to any kind of parental notification. That's part of federal law. There was an article that I read and I cited it in my book. I can't remember all of the details now, but basically, Medicaid and Medicare give a priority to promoting contraception that they do not give for other kinds of medical care. You know, so you can get it with zero deductible, for example. You can get that stuff with zero deductible, which is not true of other kinds of treatments, right? So there are a number of ways in which the federal government has for a long time been putting a wedge between children and their parents, between parents knowing what is really going on at the school or at the doctor. And those of your listeners who have children in their teens, you may remember that you took them to the doctor. At some point, you go to the pediatrician. They get to a certain age, and the pediatrician starts requesting that you leave the room and that the pediatrician have some private time with your child. That is driven by the sexual revolution. And that's been in place for quite a little while now. That's been going on. And so when you've got that kind of structure in place, it's not that hard to put something new and even more deadly into that place, to have it occupy that same place. The structure is already there. So now that, you know, you could get the pill without your parents knowing, now you can have your body mutilated without your parents knowing about it. You can get cross-sex hormones without your parents knowing about it. This is the big new cash cow for Planned Parenthood. Perhaps you saw this story. I don't know if you saw this story, Andrew, of a Planned Parenthood worker basically blowing the whistle and saying that at their clinic, you know, teenagers come in wanting to get cross-sex hormones. A group of them will come in like they're going off to get their ears pierced at the mall or something because they've all decided that they're really secretly trans, and so they go to the Planned Parenthood clinic, and Planned Parenthood gives them cross-sex hormones without their parents knowing it, and with basically a 45-minute appointment. This Planned Parenthood worker was appalled and told Abigail Shirer about it, and so that story has been out and about in the news too. Okay, the big wedge between children and their parents.
Yeah, and so with this Equality Act now, well, that as you're talking about, like the you know, these changing regulations and so forth with insurance and health procedures, will then this have an effect on giving federal funding for any of these various sex change or gender affirmation procedures and surgeries and such?
I think a lot of that's already in place, Andrew. I couldn't answer you specifically whether what this particular legislation would do that's new and beyond what's already in place. I'm sorry, I can't answer that.
Well, the whole issue.
They're pretty much already doing it, you know. And that's how a lot of these teens are able to get these surgeries and things without their parents knowing, without their parents, you know, who's paying for it? Well, somebody gets them on some form of federal health care, and that's how it gets done.
Yeah. Well, thinking of all this control again over thought and speech, if we had this Equality Act, what would be the extent of this Equality Act in terms of employment relationships and what someone says? I think of the case of Matt Barber, a conservative commentator, years ago, I guess it was back in, like, say, 2004, so he was working for Allstate, and he wrote some article on his own in opposition to homosexuality, and then got fired from his job at Allstate. I think he had to sue or something to have a settlement to protect his rights to engage in political speech. With this Equality Act, then, if you define the employment relationship to cover what a person says outside of work, does this not now mean that you can be fired from your job because you would say something in opposition to this gender dysphoria, transgenderism, or the homosexuality issues about marriage outside of work? I think of, for example, also the fire chief in Atlanta a couple of years ago who was disciplined for what he wrote in a church publication about human sexuality.
You know, the cases that you're mentioning all suggest that we're already pretty far down this track, you know. So to be specific about what the Equality Act piles on top of it, I'm not a lawyer, so I can't tell you exactly what it's going to pile on and how it's going to pile on. But it's for sure it's going to make it harder for people in those situations to defend themselves. There's no question about that. It's just one further domino being pushed down, saying that the rule of this society is that we all affirm that there's no such thing as differences between men and women that are socially significant. It's all socially constructed. It can all be socially or technologically reconstructed at will, and we all have to go along with whatever result that might produce. And if you don't go along with it, we're going to punish you. That's the new law of society. And this is just a further step along that process.
Yeah, the issue was raised years ago. I read about before when the whole issue of same-sex marriage was being debated, and before the 2015 Supreme Court decision, Obergefell, that in Canada, under their human rights commissions and hate speech laws, that in effect opposition to homosexuality had been made illegal, that if you say anything anywhere like that, you know, marriage is between a man or a woman or something, someone will sue you for hate speech. And there was a famous case also about 20 years ago or so in Canada, a mayor refused in a town to give a proclamation celebrating gay pride and a gay pride parade that was coming to town, and he was then fined before one of these human rights commissions. So if this becomes equated, if issues of human sexuality and human sex become equated with, say, racism, then I guess anyone anywhere can be punished for whatever they say. So I guess the First Amendment would become a dead letter.
Well, the whole legal strategy of the sexual revolutionaries has been to use the anti-discrimination apparatus to further their objectives. So we have the anti-discrimination apparatus that was created to protect African Americans from undue discrimination, and people were willing to go with that because people said, we've got a problem here, we've got a historical problem, we need to address it, and this is a way of addressing the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow. And so for that historical reason, we created a whole body of anti-discrimination law, and so you could call it social practices about what's socially acceptable to do and not do. Okay, so all of that is firmly entrenched in law. The strategy of the sexual revolutionaries has been to make it so that homosexual practice and now gender instability, let's put it that way, sexual identity instability, to make it so that's the legal equivalent of race, so that it's an immutable characteristic, so that it's something that you cannot change, and people are discriminating against you for something you can't help, okay? That has been their legal strategy from the beginning. Further ways in which that is playing out, and, you know, the different cases that you're mentioning are built around that as a legal strategy. But if you probe beneath the surface, the African Americans, by and large, are not on board with this redefinition of civil rights. You know, they deeply resent their civil rights movement being hijacked for the purposes of normalizing homosexuality, for example. I mean, a lot of African Americans are very religious. They're very traditional. They did not get the memo that says men and women are interchangeable. They don't believe that. Some of them are deeply, deeply resentful of this hijacking. What they see it as a hijacking of the civil rights movement and its moral authority to do something that they think is completely unworthy of that kind of legal protection. They think it's completely unworthy. And I can give you an example of this, a very interesting indirect example, you could say. Back in 2008, I was deeply involved in the Proposition 8 campaign out in California, Andrew. And 2008, you may remember that Proposition 8 was the proposition that defined marriage as the union of a man and a woman only in the California Constitution. It was a constitutional amendment that was put on the ballot. And it passed. The people of California voted yes for Proposition 8, yes for man-woman marriage, and it was taken away by the courts in Obergefell, as you noted. But if you looked at the polling data, 2008, there was something else on the ballot in 2008, and that was Barack Obama, the first black president, was on the ballot in 2008. And if you look at the racial composition of the votes for Proposition 8, you will find there are about 45% of Anglos voted yes for man-woman marriage, about 60% of Hispanics voted yes for man-woman marriage, and over 70% of African-American voters voted yes for man-woman marriage. They were the biggest, proportionately, the strongest supporters of Proposition 8. Well, think about it. All these black people went into the voting booth to vote for Barack Obama, the first black president, and while they were in there, oh, by the way, they voted yes for man-woman marriage, okay? And that is a reality that neither party has fully acknowledged, and neither party has confronted the significance of what that actually means. The Democrats would prefer to sweep it under the rug. You know, they don't want to look too closely. They don't want you and me looking at it too closely. And the Republican Party, frankly, has never known what to do with that fact. You know, they there's just too many people in the Republican establishment who are wobbly on the social issues anyway. They just don't know what to do with the fact that there's an opportunity sitting there that they've never taken advantage of.
Yeah, that's an interesting breakdown. I didn't realize it was precisely black. I knew that there's strong minority support for Proposition 8, but that specific breakdown, I didn't realize it's precisely 70% of blacks. I'd forgotten that it was also in the same year, 2008, as Barack Obama's election. Of course, there was the saying that many blacks had made precisely on this issue that your sin is not the same as my skin was a common phrase. Discrimination against.
Yes, they did say that. They would say that. And, you know, one of my friends says, Criminy, you can see I'm black from a block away. You can tell I'm black. I can't tell you're lesbian unless I talk to you. You know, it's like a whole different scale of immutable trait here, you know?
Yeah, and there's also a fundamental issue. I mean, trying to equate, like, Caitlyn Jenner, as we now have to call him, Rosa Parks.
Don't call him that. Don't call him that. Do not call him Caitlyn. Well, I guess he changed his name, but Caitlyn he male Caitlin. Go ahead.
Yeah, male Caitlin. Caitlin, the man. The man formerly known as Bruce, who identifies as Caitlin. I guess we could call him. We could have a new like Prince type acronym. The
right.
artist formerly
right.
known.
right.
Gets
right.
complicated
right.
here. But you know, such individuals. Speaking of this movement, one thing I thought of is that if you think of blacks in the United States, African Americans who've suffered so much under slavery and segregation, and have really been a population that has had to really strive and struggle and work their way up in society against so many disadvantages. Whereas this whole LGBT movement is very much, as you've noted, an elite movement, a very, you know, globalist elite
yeah.
that are pushing this, you know, Bruce, now Caitlyn Jenner, this man who identifies as a woman. You know, he was a successful athlete, very wealthy. You know, Rachel Levine went to Harvard and a very prestigious boarding school and so forth. You know, these are actually very wealthy, very upper crust, successful people. So I'm sure blacks would say, hey, look, you know, we struggled a lot to come into be full members of society, whereas all you're doing is demanding approval for your sexual and lifestyle behavior. This is just totally different.
It's completely different. It's completely different. And people are afraid to say anything about it, you know, and people's fear of speaking is one of the big advantages that they have generated for themselves. And this, again, this is something Stella Morabito is very strong on, that she has pointed out to us that if we censor ourselves, we're doing the work of our opponents in that way, you know, that we simply can't afford to censor ourselves, and people are afraid. And because they're afraid, they're not saying what they ought to say when they ought to say it. And therefore it looks like the other side is winning. They're not really winning in the sense of actually convincing anybody. That's not what's at work. What's at work is people being more and more fearful.
Yeah, so there is indeed a paper tiger kind of, you know, bark bigger than the bite aspect here. Well, thinking of the Equality Act coming up for debate in the Senate, what can people do to oppose this bill? What are the chances of it being stopped in the Senate? What could someone do if it does indeed pass?
Well, I think there's a good chance that it can be stopped, if assuming that that its opponents will stand their ground and filibuster it and do those kinds of parliamentary things that need to be done. So you should really, by all means, tell your senator that you do not want the Equality Act to pass, that you think equality is misnamed. It's an inequality act. It's a power grab by the government, and that you don't want it. And you need to that's what people need to be able to do at this point.
And is there any backlash that's occurring against the Democrats for this bill? I mean, this doesn't really seem like the normalcy that President Joe Biden promised us during the campaign. How are people receiving this bill?
I don't know what you mean by a backlash. I mean, people make noise and say they don't like it. But the thing you have to understand about revolutionaries, Andrew, is that the issue is never the issue. The issue is always the revolution, and the revolution is always about power. So if we make noise, that's fine. They can withstand noise, you know. They don't really care about the noise, you know. As long as they're continuing to move in their direction and promote the revolution, that's really all they care about. So I don't know what you mean by backlash. I don't see significant quote backlash that is going to be particularly discouraging to the committed revolutionary. But that doesn't mean that we need to stop fighting. We need to fight it on multiple levels. Something at the top of society like this, like the Equality Act, of course, it's very significant, but it's also harder for the ordinary person to fight. The other kinds of things that your listeners should be doing is you should be paying very close attention to what's going on in your local public school, even your local non-public school, your local Christian school, your local Catholic school. You got to be very careful about what's being taught there. And that's a place where you can actually have an impact. You know, you can go to the principal, you can go to the school board, you can get involved there, and you need to do that, particularly people who are retired and who can't be fired from their jobs. You know, you need to be out there and saying this material is not acceptable. And we don't want you sexualizing the children. We don't want you destabilizing a five-year-old's sense of identity to tell this little boy that he could become a little girl, that it's not clear whether he'll grow up to be a boy or a girl. You got to stop that. So I think the most important thing for your listeners to be thinking about is where in this whole sexual revolutionary juggernaut can I get involved at the local level where I can get something done, where I have the hope of getting something done. That's what you need to be thinking about.
Yeah, that brings up an interesting issue that all these sexual revolutionaries with discrimination law and other effects are really trying to leverage the power of the marketplace. But in contrast, Robert Riley, who wrote the book on Making Gay Okay, another leading Catholic intellectual, he noted once that, he says the things that he says precisely because he's retired. I mean, you can't fire him anymore. And so I guess this would be an important thing for any retired people who are looking out for a project to take on in their post-employment years to look at. Well, you mentioned schools, like Catholic schools. Are there going to be any religious exemptions to this Equality Act? What's the outlook for religious freedom under this bill?
No exemptions, baby. No exemptions. No religious exemptions. Outlook for religious freedom? Bleak, bleak, bleak. That's all I can say about that. No. See, and here's the thing. I really like the fact that you only brought that up in the last 5 minutes program, Andrew, because a lot of our strategy as conservatives and social conservatives, we've spent way too much energy on religious freedom and religious exemptions, way too much energy. You've got to fight the thing itself. You can't stand there and say, I have the right opinion because it says so in the First Amendment. No, you've got to say, my opinion happens to be scientifically sound. My opinion happens to be more humane than what you're proposing. And you got to spend most of your time and energy on that point. If all else fails, yeah, go for the religious liberty arguments. But we put way too much emphasis on that, in my opinion. So the outlook is certainly bleak. On that point, if the Equality Act passes, these people don't care about your religious freedom, okay? They don't care about that. And they'll squash your religious liberty like they're stepping on a bug. They don't care about that at all. But if you can show that you're hurting people, and that it's factually incorrect, and that it's not scientific, and that it's a power grab, now you've got a chance of moving some of those same people, right? The people who don't care about your religious liberty, some of them are going to listen to those points, and that's why I think we need to put most of our emphasis there.
Yeah, I guess recurring again to the French Revolution analogy, the original revolutionaries and power grab, they didn't care with their guillotine or with the genocide of Catholics in the Vendée during the Vendée Revolt about religious liberty there. And certainly in a non-violent fashion, people today are not going to care about your religious liberty either. They're going to crush you. You'll keep your head, but not your religious freedom, perhaps. I guess I would analogize too to the pro-life movement. That's not first and foremost about religious liberty, but has indeed emphasized factual arguments about the beginnings of human life or issues of pain, fetal pain during abortions and so forth. That it'd be a very silly to approach the issue of abortion just from religious freedom. Well, how do you think schools will change under this act? It may be one closing thought.
Well, I think they're going to be under even more pressure to conform. The kind of thing that we saw under the Obama era, when they sent a dear colleague letter and told everybody that you're going to lose your federal funding unless you do X, Y, and Z. That kind of thing is only going to get more extreme, and they won't have to send out letters. It'll be already ready. That you have to conform to these strictures of the children will not be able to have sex segregated bathrooms and showering facilities and things like that. Women's sports are going to go away. Okay, women's sports is going to be gone. You just have to face up to that. The men who say they are women, for whatever reason they say they are women, they are going to win all the prizes in women's sports. Women's sports are a thing of the past. That's the consequence, the direct, immediate consequence of the Equality Act, and it'll affect the little kids all the way up to professional women's sports. It's over.
Yeah, it's interesting indeed. Tennessee recently passed a local law to prohibit men who identify as women from participating in women's sports. But I guess any such local state initiative will then be crushed under this federal law of the Equality Act if it's passed. And as you say, that's going to be the end of women's sports.
Yeah, there's going to be litigation over that for sure. There's going to be a lot of litigation. But, you know, what the law does, what the Equality Act does, is to throw the burden of proof onto a different party. You know, now you have to prove that you're right and we're wrong, that you have to prove that the statute is incorrect. You know, and so the burden of proof is shifting all around. And that's part of the strategy as well.
Oh, I see. So you have to show that you have a legitimate reason to keep such men who identify as women out of women's sports. But under the law, it'd be prima facie, you know, you're discriminating, that sex discrimination.
I
see.
I think that's right. I think that's how it would go, yeah.
All right. Well, excellent. Well, for my listeners out there, you've been listening to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Harris. And we've been discussing the Equality Act, a really misnamed Inequality Act, with Dr. Jennifer Roback Ward, a founder of the Ruth Institute and author of the book, The Sexual State, How Elite Ideologies Are Destroying Lives and Why the Church Was Right All Along. Well, Jennifer Roback Ward, thank you for joining the show.
You're very welcome. Glad to do it. Thanks, Andrew.
All right. Well, tune in next time for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday.